I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, from New York Governor David Patterson's political troubles to the Hollywood Awards, the Barbershop Guys are going to give their take. That is later in the program. But first, a newsmaker interview with Labor Secretary Hilda Solis. This week, the Senate approved a $15 billion jobs bill. It was the first major piece of legislation the Congress has moved since Christmas, and it passed with decent bipartisan support. It now goes to the House. But critics are already taking aim from left and right, with some saying it is too little too late. Other critics are saying that the $15 billion is more than the U.S. government can afford. We wanted to talk more about this, so we called the Secretary of Labor, Hilda Solis. She joined us by phone from California. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
How are you, Michelle?
I'm well, thank you. Now, I want to mention you have a number of initiatives that you've been working on, and we want to talk about as many of them as we can. But I want to start with an article in today's New York Times reporting that the Obama administration plans to use the government's enormous buying power to prod companies to improve wages and benefits. Is that true, and how does that work?
Well, I think, the president spoke very clearly about expanding support for small businesses by giving a $5,000 tax credit for every new employee that a business hires for this year, 2010. And I think that will help to incentivize businesses to give them the, confidence to go ahead and move forward and bring people on. We also will be providing, if this package is approved, also provide businesses a reimbursement for through their Social Security payroll taxes, which also has a direct, immediate impact for small businesses. But one of the things I think that's very, very important is that the president is really looking at a couple of things. We know that local and state government are in trouble. Many of their budgets are at deficit points right now, and we need to also consider that when we put together a job package. So I know that the meeting that we had last week with the Governors Association, that was very much talked about, and there seems to be a lot of bipartisan support on helping to provide those needed funds for our local government and state government. And when I say that, we're talking about law enforcement, we're talking about healthcare clinics, we're also talking about teachers and things of that nature that really impact our local community. So if these people are turned away or laid off or services are closed, that has another additional negative impact on our economy.
Sure.
So you realize we have to do something now.
No, I understand that, but I'm specifically asking about this whole question of whether using the contracting process to make more demands of employers, and that was the specific thing I wanted to ask you about. Of course, there are those who would say that the more demands that you make on employers, the less flexibility you give them, the less likely they are to move forward with hiring because they're already so skittish right now. That's the question I would have about that.
Well, I think that for contracting, what's really important is that one of the things that we care very much about at Department of Labor is making sure that people get good wages, so that at a time when we know that people are making less, their hours are being cut back, we want to make sure if we are providing contracts that there is a balance in the workplace, that people really are able to earn a good salary, that employers are abiding by the rules, and this isn't a time to kind of skirt the law. So that is a very important aspect of what we oversee in the Department of Labor. So that is very important. And as we put out a lot of funds for infrastructure, for rail, high-speed rail projects, transportation and infrastructure, all those elements come into play. And I would say that you actually provide a level of security, safety, and competency in these projects when you do require that there are more, high points that have to be met to bid for these projects and to really be able to have the right people on the job. And in many cases, sometimes you'll have a project that's completed before it's actually supposed to be built, and that saves the government a lot of money as well.
Well, let's move on to the jobs bill. Of course, there was a lot of people were very appreciative that the Senate actually finally moved forward on some kind of legislation to address the unemployment situation. But of course, there are those who still say this is really just a gesture. Here's the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who we caught up with in London yesterday. This is what he had to say.
So about 20 million Americans unemployed, about 40 million in poverty. It does not correspond to the size of the problem. Wall Street got a bailout, but the working people are really getting a gesture by comparison.
How do you respond to that, Madam Secretary?
Well, I would say that, first of all, we are still in the process of pushing more of our recovery monies out that was approved last year in February. And I would say that about 65% to 70% of that money has gone out, but we still have a lot of those projects that have been encumbered. And so you really haven't seen, for example, construction projects fully on the ground. That will also be impacting us in the next few months, in the next two quarters. So you're going to see a lot of activity, a lot of investments that the president has made that have been very, very targeted to help incentivize more job creation, whether it's in the area of providing small businesses with more loans. For example, that alone, $20 billion has been made available to 42,000 small businesses. So that is something that's unprecedented. So we're hoping that with the confidence in the market, which we see now because we're seeing that slippage now in the job loss, where last year we saw 700,000 jobs lost, now it's 20,000. That's not good enough, but we can see that we have to build confidence, and the president has put those mechanisms in place, I believe, to help structure that recovery that we need. He also put $50 billion in to help prevent the cuts in Medicaid, $60 billion in funding for education that the governors used to help provide additional safety net for those people that are teachers. A lot of that is helping to keep people on the job as well. And we know that 31 states also have benefited from the high-speed rail projects that I talked about. And those are projects that are going to go well beyond the Recovery Act. They're going to probably be 5- and 10-year projects. So people will be working. 48 advanced battery and electric drive projects have been funded in 20 states worth $2.4 billion. In transportation and construction projects, 12,500 projects have been funded. And as I said, not all of them have been, fully implemented because of weather conditions. You know, the snow is pretty bad back in the Northeast.
Oh, we know.
And you're going to see the highway construction and airport projects coming about. So I think that there is a lot of things that have yet to be realized, but the public needs to be confident. The president is working very, very hard. The first item that he took up was the Recovery Act. And I can say to you that there are many Republicans as well as Democrats that know that this has saved anywhere from 2 million to 2.4 million jobs. We hope that at the end of the Recovery Act, that's the end of this year, 2010, that we will have created well over 3.5 million jobs.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with the Secretary of Labor, Hilda Solis. We're talking about the jobs bill, and we're also talking about the current state of the economy and the efforts that the Obama administration is making, along with members of Congress, to address this situation. You know, to that end, I know you know probably better than anybody that African Americans and Latinos have been disproportionately affected by this recession. Latinos are the largest group of people by numbers who are unemployed, and the unemployment rate among African Americans is much higher than the general population. Now, you've talked about this in the past, and you've talked about the educational gap as one reason that this, you know, for these circumstances, but that takes a long time to fix. And there are some who'd argue now that these groups, that there should be efforts that are specifically targeted to these groups. In the same way, for example, that, you know, the H1N1 vaccine was initially targeted toward the groups that were most likely to get sick. So there are some who say a similar philosophy ought to apply to the groups that are disproportionately affected by the recession. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say that we have attempted it in many ways to try to target our funding. A lot of our money, as you know, is formula-based, so it's really hard to just pull out an amount of money and thrust it in a certain direction. But I'll tell you what we did here for green jobs that we had received $750 million for job training programs. A good chunk of that money, I would say anywhere from 100 to 200 million, was targeted to communities that were hardest hit. And we just recently issued grants in the green renewable energy area, the targeted areas that had 15% unemployment and higher. And we particularly asked for new partnerships to be developed that were reflective of community-based organizations and also addressing the diversity in these communities. So I had just met with the Black Caucus this week earlier, and we talked about it, and many of them were very happy that we used this formula. And I know that they are now talking to other agencies about using these kind of innovative processes so that we can really get the money out to those very high-need areas. And I, in particular, asked my staff as I became Secretary of Labor to look at our guidance, to look at how we could describe the conditions in our economy so that we could make that adjustment. So if you saw a high number of dislocated people in rural communities, that we really made sure that we went out of our way to target those particular areas. And you know, these are all competitive grants, so it's very hard. Sometimes our local communities out there are not prepared or have the technical assistance to put these proposals together. So we're attempting to do as much as we can beforehand, before we issue the guidance, to tell them exactly what we're looking for and to bring people together, provide technical assistance. And for those people that didn't get grants, we want to help them in the next round of funding. But more importantly, what I will tell you is I get criticized so much for people saying, well, Secretary, what is a green job? We're not ready for this. And I'm saying, yes, you are. You are ready. And we had so many applications, we couldn't even begin to fund more. We were only able to fund 20%. And the 80% of the people that did, the communities that did put proposals together, would qualify for funding if we had money. But we need bipartisan support. We need the Republicans to get off the duff and say, look, we support these projects because we know it's an investment in our human capital. But there will be jobs that will be established here in our neighborhoods that won't be outsourced, that will help to reduce our dependency on foreign oil, and also create energy conservation methods that will draw down the cost of energy, especially for minority communities.
And finally, Madam Secretary, and we've only just scratched the surface of all the things that you're working on, so we hope you'll come back and talk to us again about all the other things you're working on. But how do you respond in the minute that we have left to the argument that people on both the left and the right are making now, that this administration was just too late to prioritize unemployment, that it has been, I don't know if the word is distracted, but so preoccupied with other issues like health care to the point where it is not focused enough on this very real bread and butter issue for so many people right now who are out of work?
Yeah, you know, I understand people's anger and anguish. I've been out there 30 states, been traveling rural America where hardest hit communities, Native Americans, blacks, and Latinos are affected. And I'll tell you that one of the frustrations I have is that this is the first time that so much money through the American Recovery Act has been provided in these programs that existed many years ago. So it's hard to get our communities to understand and get ready for that transition. And just getting money out quickly was a very big task. We were able to put 317,000 students into the Summer Youth Employment Program, and we originally thought only 150,000 would participate.
Well, Madam Secretary, we have to leave it there for now. We hope you'll come back and see us. That was Secretary of Labor Hilda Solis. She was kind enough to join us by phone from her home in California. Madam Secretary, we thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, as Black History Month comes to a close for this year, we catch up with Olympic speed skater Shawnee Davis, who made history in 2006 as the first African-American to win an individual medal at a Winter Olympic Games. He repeated his winning ways last week. We'll ask him about what it takes to be a champion and how he really feels about the focus on his race as well as his performance. That's later in the program. But first, more of the week in politics. Along with a jobs bill, the big news was the president's health care summit held yesterday. The six-hour GabFest, which was televised, was billed as a bid to break through the political stalemate on a health care overhaul. So how did all that work out? Also, veteran lawmaker Charles Rangel, the chairman of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee, was admonished by the House Ethics Committee for violating the rules on corporate gifts. We wanted to know more about all that, so we've called Pam Gentry, senior political analyst with BET, Black Entertainment Television. She keeps us up to date on these issues. She's with us again. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having
me. So, you know, everybody's talking about that healthcare summit as political theater. Now, I don't know what's so terrible about that. I mean, you know, half of politics is theater. But now that it's over, what are the reviews coming in? Whose performance is being, you know, how are the performances being assessed?
I think there are mixed reviews, but I think that the best part of all of this reform was the back and forth sections where there was clear disagreement in ideology or in how policy should be carried out, and both sides made their cases. I think the president also demonstrated his breadth of knowledge of the topics, that his willingness to listen, and I think his willingness to make some concessions if he felt that they were valid.
Well, so, he also demonstrated his willingness to fight on some of the to not sort of roll over. I just want to play a short clip from an exchange with Congressman Eric Cantor, the Republican whip, and this is the president kind of getting a little shot in there. Here it is.
You know, when we do props like this, you stack it up and you repeat 2,400 pages, et cetera. You know, the truth of the matter is that Healthcare is very complicated. And try to pretend that it's not, but it is.
Okay, so maybe it wasn't exactly a knife fight, but you know.
Well, one of the ones where there was a knife fight was someone when he kind of reminded Senator John McCain when he started speaking, kind of giving the political rhetoric that they've been accused of doing on health care reform. He said to him, John, the campaign is over. And I think those were the kinds of moments that American public had to sit back and say, well, let's see exactly what they're talking about in substance.
Do you think at the end of the day that summit moved the debate along in either direction?
I don't know if it moved the debate along, but I wish it had happened maybe 13 months ago. I think that this public discussion of the back and forth and explaining the complexities of healthcare reform, because I worked at HHS, I understand that these are programs that there is no one small piece. And I think that's the one point that everyone made yesterday. You can't really do part of healthcare reform. You've got to do almost all of it because it's so intermingled.
Well, that's one side of it, though. That's the Democratic argument. It has to be comprehensive. The Republicans are saying that that's not so. That was Lamar Alexander's.
Well, they've pulled out almost every part that they can. I mean, if you look at how we're running healthcare now, we have like five different programs as it is. And so there's only a little bit left, and the largest part that's left are the uninsured.
So a case was made, and it kind of lays the groundwork for whatever happens next. Speaking of a case, Charlie Rangel, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, that's the tax writing committee. It's traditionally one of the most powerful committees,
right,
on the Hill, faces discipline after House Ethics Committee finds that he violated House gift rules by accepting trips to the Caribbean, which were funded by a corporation. What do you think he will do in response to this? He gave a statement last night, very defiant, said, I didn't.
The interesting part about this, when I first reported on this story as well, is that before they took this trip, this conference has been going on for about 13 years. Before they took this trip, they went to the Ethics Committee, and the Ethics Committee went over it and approved it, and they all went on the trip. And then they get back from the trip, and this organization—
When you say they,
talking about? I think there was Congressman Kilpatrick. There were five members of the CBC. I think it was Kilpatrick, Benny Thompson. I can't remember all their names right now.
So five members of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Right. They decide that they can go on this trip, and they go on the trip. This organization called the National Legal and Policy Center has one of their representatives, the vice president, I think his name is Ken Bolin. He goes down, takes his camera, shoots all these videos and photographs of, and says that this event was part of some, that it was corporate sponsored, and here are the sponsors. Comes back, writes a long letter to the Ethics Committee and to the general public or members that support his organization saying, Charlie Rangel and all of these folks went down here to this, event. They shouldn't have been there. And the Ethics Committee starts investigating. They end up coming back after all this time, and they slap him on the wrist and say that he didn't know that this was corporate sponsored. The Ethics Committee really didn't know it was corporate sponsored or approved it. But he should have known that his staff knew. And so they slap him on the wrist. It's convoluted to me. It's either that all of the members who went should have been admonished, or they should have decided to wait until they had more to make a decision.
Well, they didn't. They exonerated the other four, but
they
said
did.
That he deserved to be criticized for this. What about this? What are the implications? Republicans are saying he should step down. That his he's just impaired as a leader because of this. Is there any sense that he will?
I don't think so, because I don't think that Charles Rangel feels that he has done anything wrong, and he feels like he did make the right steps going to the Ethics Committee before taking it. And he also has to kind of stand up to this organization, because they have sent out a letter as of May of 2009, the National Legal and Council, saying that they've got to get him, and help us get him. And
so he's saying this is a partisan political attack,
well,
and that's how it is.
He doesn't say that. I'm saying it because I have their letters and I've seen the proof. He never mentions this organization. He never mentions who is really behind a lot of these investigations. But I'm saying that I think that they are motivated to go after him.
To be continued, Pam Gentry is the senior political analyst for BET, Black Entertainment Television. She's kind enough to drop by from time to time to keep us up to date on matters of Congress and the White House and so forth, and politics in general. Pam, thank you so much for stopping by.
Always a pleasure.
More politics. It's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for A Shape Up this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete, author and professor of public policy at George Mason University Michael Fontroy, and NPR's political editor Ken Rudin. Take it away, Jimmy. No Jimmy. Okay, well, I'll take it away, Jimmy. And whenever you come out from under the Clippers, you can jump right in. The big news today, I think, in the political world, even though this is New York based, I think it has repercussions because for the politics of it and sort of the metaphor of it is New York Governor David Patterson. He's under fire. He's been criticized in the New York Times for a couple of days now about his relationship with a top aide. First, they questioned his qualifications, and then the question was, how did he respond to some very serious allegations of domestic abuse that his aide was accused of, and then the governor's behavior in the course of that has come under fire because he has admitted that he called the complaining woman and it's not clear why he called her. So now David Patterson has made the decision that he will not be a candidate for re-election, only days after he said he would run for re-election. Now, Ken Rudin, you previously told us on this program you never thought he would be the nominee.
No, from the beginning, the stars were aligned against him. Remember when he first took office in March of 2008, one of the first things he announced was that he and his wife had separate affairs. I mean, his relationship with the state legislature was bad. The White House, the Barack Obama White House, said from the beginning that he should not run for a full term and without specifically endorsing somebody else. But that's somebody else is Andrew Cuomo. He's a state attorney general, son of Mario Cuomo, the former three-term governor. Very, very popular. And unlike David Patterson, has a history of winning elections and doing very well in the polls.
Isn't this a little awkward, though, now that David Patterson had said just a day or so ago that he thought that Cuomo should investigate this allegations of whether he acted inappropriately in calling this woman who was the alleged victim of this domestic assault. So isn't that weird? He's going to be investigated by the guy who's trying to get his job?
It's like a scandal in the Obama White House, and I'm asking John Boehner to investigate for them, or asking Michael Steele to investigate an Obama investigation. It is very weird, but of course, as the top legal officer in New York, Andrew Cuomo is the guy. Now, I would suspect that if anything, Andrew Cuomo would hand it off to a special or an independent prosecutor, because otherwise you don't want to come off as a political kind of investigation when obviously everybody would assume that's what it is.
So David Patterson's political career is over at this point.
It is, and it's kind of sad because, of course, we know he's an accidental governor, Elliot Spitzer having resigned in March of 2008 because of a prostitution scandal, and so he was just put in as lieutenant governor. Usually we don't even know who the lieutenant governors are. Who remembers Malcolm Wilson or Marianne Krupp? These are former lieutenant governors of New York that nobody ever can remember. But the fact is, he was the first African-American governor of New York. Obviously, for a lot of people, want him to do well. His father was well-liked. Basil Patterson ran for lieutenant governor back in 1970. He's been involved in Harlem politics for decades. And yet, it just seemed like he was never cut out for this job.
And I want to mention that the governor was actually scheduled to speak with us today. And he confirmed that his office confirmed that he would be speaking with us as recently as yesterday morning. And then, of course, later in the afternoon, he canceled. So we certainly do hope at some point he'll come and speak with us. And he did give a press conference last night. I just want to play a short clip where he said that he was very clearly trying to figure out, what to do. And I'll just play a short clip just so you can sort of hear how he sounded last night. Here it is. Mm-hmm.
I'm not suspending my campaign, but I am talking to a number of elected officials around the state, as I would fellow Democrats, to hear their opinions. I'm obviously listening to them. I've got an open mind about this thing. I want the Democrats to win in November. I want the governor of the state of New York to be Democratic, hopefully me. I will weigh what they have to say, but right now I'm a candidate for governor.
So, Ruben, what do you make of all this? I mean, here you're
yeah.
You're kind of a tough on everybody person. What do you make of all this?
Today,
what do you think you should do?
I'm going to be tough on the New York Times. I think that in general, here's the thing. We got to look at this in the big picture. I don't believe for a minute that Governor Patterson sort of never intended to run. I think he did intend to run. I think he wanted the natural impulse for a politician who's the incumbent governor of New York is to run for re-election. And I think those plans were derailed ultimately by his own alleged stupid behavior. I mean, completely inappropriate behavior is alleged here. The fact that not just would the governor seem to be applying pressure to this woman, this victim of domestic violence, but having state police officers with badges and guns visit the woman to apply a different kind of pressure as well, that is just completely beyond the pale. That is completely unacceptable. That's what cooked his goose in the long run, if all this is true. But having said that, I said from the beginning, there are folks in New York who always wanted Andrew Cuomo to be governor, never wanted Patterson there. They saw him as an illegitimate heir who was only there because of what happened to Eliot Spitzer. And the New York Times and others have been leading this crusade to get him out. And we need to be able to say that. If this were Fox News, we'd have no trouble saying it. The fact that the New York Times is the pillar of the liberal media establishment, to my mind, doesn't insulate it from criticism for its almost vindictive pursuit of Governor Patterson.
Michael Fontrey, what do you think of this? What do you make of that?
Well, it's equally sad, but it's also politically pathetic. I mean, it turns out that Governor Patterson is no longer politically viable, and given what's going on with the state police, no longer ethically viable as governor. You know, a lot of us lost our minds during the 2000 campaign when it turned out that Sarah Palin had been accused of having some inappropriate contact with state police regarding her sister in a divorce case. So, you know, it just seems to me that what we have here is someone who sort of fell into the job, was never really well suited for, and all of this sort of fountain of incompetence has sort of sprayed out all over the state, and now there's a big mess. And unfortunately, I'm not certain Andrew Cuomo could save it.
Rich, what do you make of his comments earlier on the CNN program, Larry King, and before he was starting his pushback, or his before the pieces were even published, where he said, well, this is an effort to racialize me and sexualize me. And he really did put it in kind of a racial context, that he was being attacked in part not just because he's the governor, the highest ranking, or a Democrat, but because he's an African-American. I mean, he's the first African-American governor of the state of New York.
Well, Michelle, that there may well be something to that, but the reality is that does not sort of overcome all of this other stuff that's going on.
Right.
And for that reason, you know, it sort of rings hollow, though it may well be true.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly visit to the barbershop. We're speaking with Michael Fontrey, Ken Rudin, Ruben Navarrete, and hopefully Jimmy's back with us. Jimmy, are you there?
I'm here.
There you are. I don't know where you've been. So busy getting your shape up. You didn't have time for us. So Jimmy, I wanted to ask you about and try to contain yourself, one of your favorite people, the Reverend Al Sharpton, and one of your other favorite people, Tavis Smiley, the talk show host, who got into this heated debate over, you know, and the reason I think one of the reasons we're interested in this is that the question for David Patterson is he's the first black governor. He's the governor of New York, a very important state, a political important figure in his own right. But he's also an African-American governor. And is there some sort of broader swirl around that? And it leads to this debate that they had over whether President Obama has a specific responsibility to address the specific concerns of African-Americans. Jimmy, you want to talk more about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I for me, that's kind of troubling, you know. And this, you know what, I'm going to get in a lot of trouble because everybody knows I'm down on the Reverend Al sometime. But I think this may be one of the Ruben hold still. I think this may be one of the cases where Al Sharpton is dangerous when he's on message, and he's on message. You know, Tavis,
I fell off my chair. Oh,
Tavis, this looks like his ego has gotten the best of him. He wants to be king of all blacks desperately. You know, and in my opinion, I think he's trying to by suggesting that other black leaders set the agenda. He's trying to be the vanguard of that, and I think that's a problem.
We need to take a short break because I'm going to play a little bit of this after we take our break, just so that everybody who hasn't followed this knows what we're talking about. But before we do, Michael Fontrey, I wanted to ask your assessment of this. Is this kind of just egoism at its finest, or is this a kind of political maturity that people, prominent African Americans, can feel free to disagree publicly?
Well, it's unfortunate. You know, Tavis is a friend of mine, and I've said to others that I think in this case he may have used an Uzi when a pistol may have been a more appropriate weapon, because he sort of sprayed a whole bunch of people that I don't think he necessarily needed to. I think they're legitimate questions with regard to Sharpton. I'm fine with people debating things publicly. I'm not fine with some of the sort of personalizing of it that I think is beginning to happen. And unfortunately, it looks like this is the start of something new.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll have more on this with public policy professor Michael Fontrey, journalist Jimmy Israel, Ruben Navarrete, and Ken Rudin. We'll tell you a little bit more about what we're talking about. We'll actually play some of the exchange so you can decide for yourself whether you think this matters or not. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Please stay with us. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, Olympic speed skater Shawnee Davis is the first African-American to win an individual medal at a Winter Olympic Games. We'll talk about sport and race in a few minutes. But first, we want to continue our conversation with our barbershop guys. We're visiting with public policy professor Michael Fauntroy, journalist Jimmy Israel, Ruben Navarrete, Ken Rudin. And Jimmy, before we go to you, I wanted to play that clip that I'd mentioned before the break. We'd been talking about this beef between Reverend Al Sharpton and the talk show host Tavis Smiley, and they got into a conversation about whether President Obama has a responsibility to set a national agenda specifically for African Americans. And I just want to play a short clip. What happened first is that Tavis called into the Tom Joyner show and said, which is, of course, a popular nationally syndicated program, and said that—
It was a commentary.
With a commentary, but he says he's convening— right. He's convening a gathering of black thought leaders to talk about this. And he criticized Al Sharpton for having a meeting with the president where he says they didn't specifically press hard enough. And here's that clip.
Mm-hmm. Is that Tavis Smiley?
Reverend Al, how are you, sir?
I was fine till you stopped messing with me this morning. What's wrong with you?
Nothing's wrong with me, and I'm not messing with you or Brother Ogletree. What I said this morning was whether or not there needs to be a black agenda. And when there are certain African-American leaders, including respectfully and lovingly, as I said this morning, the two on this phone right now, who are quoted in the New York Times and other places coming out of meetings in the White House suggesting we don't need to have this president focus on an African-American agenda, given that black folk are getting crushed, I think there's a disconnect between those kinds of quotes and black people.
And then later on, this debate carried on in another program, and here's Reverend Al's response a little bit later. Here it is.
Saying the president shouldn't value a black agenda is not saying the president should not be held to a black agenda or deal with a black agenda. And that is not what you said. Don't talk to us like we stupid, Tavis. Hold on a minute. We're going to take a break, and then I'm going to let you say whatever you want to say. But if you want to deal with truth, let's deal with truth lovingly. But don't love me and distort me. Keeping it real. Sharpton, that's my name. I'll be right back.
So he did let him respond. I just want to know he didn't just like use the mic and cut him off, but he did let him respond. Go ahead, Ruben.
I got to get in. Listen, I've known Tavis for 17 years. Obviously, he and I once hosted a radio show together in Los Angeles when we were kids. And I'll tell you what, and I have always, there have been times where I've disagreed with him, times where I've done so in public and in print. In this case, It is just wrong, I think, to make this about Tavis's ego. First of all, if you listen to that clip and you know anything about Reverend Al, this is not one humble brother we're talking about with Al Sharpton. He's got his own ego to deal with. You know, Al Sharpton looks in the mirror and he sees Denzel Washington looking back. It's the way it is. So there is a lot there with egos on all parties and all of the players in this drama. But there is a big question here. And what really set Tavis off was a story in early February in the New York Times that talked about Obama's nuanced approach to race. And in it, they made reference to Al Sharpton, Ogletree, Charles Ogletree at Harvard and others, basically giving the president a pass and saying that they wouldn't hold him to the same sort of standard they might hold a white president to. And Tavis brings up a very important point. He says, how can we give President Obama a pass and then one, down the line when we have another white president, as I think we're all sure we will at some point, then come back and resurrect the moral authority to press him on our issues? This is a really important debate. Tavis's point is very well taken. I think a lot of the criticism you hear from Reverend Al was based on jealousy and envy, where I think Sharpton gave that away was when he talked about people who go out and sell books. I mean, Tavis Smiley has a bigger microphone than Al Sharpton, and it bugs the hell out of me.
Okay. All right, Jimmy, what about you?
There's a couple.
Because I'm not sure it's about ego or it's about tactics. Is it really about that they disagree on the substance, or do they just agree tactically about what is the best approach here? But, Jimmy, what do you think?
I think it's tactics. I do. I think that Reverend Al Sharpton, what he's saying to Tavis is, look, you know, this is the president of America, not the president of black America. Let him get in and do his thing. And what's good for America is good for black people, too, right? Right, Ruben?
Well, no. Let me say no, because we—
No, okay. All right.
I'm going to say no, because typically, I'd say the same thing about Latinos. We've typically have talked about things like Latino education and black home ownership. When we have a white president, we don't have a problem setting out a black agenda, you know, and saying that if you fix the educational system in this country, a high tide lifts all boats, to use a Tavis Smiley phrase, and all of a sudden black folks are going to come along for the ride. That has not been good enough when we've had a white president. The thing that black people are struggling with is the paradox of having a black president who does not advocate specifically for black folks, and they don't know how to deal with it.
And Michael, what do you think?
I was just going to say,
you wrote about this, actually.
Yeah, I actually think that this is part of the real problem here. We are ignoring the larger question that Tavis is raising, and that is whether or not the president should pay attention to black issues. I think the answer to that question is yes, because special problems require special solutions. In Milwaukee in 2008 and 2009, the black male unemployment rate was about 50%. In Washington, D.C. in late 2009, black males between 16 and 24 were unemployed at about 35%. You know, that's way beyond the 10% that everybody's jumping up and down about right now, and it won't be reduced by simply focusing on everybody. And so I just think that Sharpton and those who take that position need to know that a rising tide is not going to lift every boat the way they think.
I'm going to go to Ken on this, but I just want to point out that Reverend Sharpton actually just called us to tell us to give his perspective. We just don't have the ability to kind of just put him
he's
into
everywhere.
Our
that
conversation.
Everywhere.
He said he called to say
he heard his
that
name.
The president invited that right his on. The meeting that he had with the president. He was invited not as Al Sharpton individual, but as a representative of a group, as were the other people that Mark Morial was invited, the president of the Urban League. He's invited the National Council of Negro Women leader, Dorothy Height, was invited. She wasn't able to come because of the weather. And he, his group, and he, the president, asked each group about their agenda. He says, and so Reverend Al says, what is that if not a black agenda? And he just said, for the record, he does think this is about ego. I don't know. Ken, what do you think?
Well,
no small ego for Kenny Rudin.
Well, first of all, yeah. I thought that I thought Rubin's argument was excellent. I think he articulated better than I ever heard it. I think ego, yes, is involved here. And sure, it's easy to say that, well, President Obama is the president of everybody, and his policies will raise up everybody, including African Americans. I could see the argument clearly, though, that some kind of a signal, at least maybe a kind of a policy or a major aid, somebody should say that, look, we know what we're doing, and this is exactly where we're focusing. But I could see at the same time where Obama's, you know, the argument that Obama should direct his appeal towards African Americans would probably, you know, alienate half the administration.
Well, that's the question.
Yeah,
that's the
like
question. I think Ken
Rudin,
that's a legitimate.
Right.
Go ahead, Jimmy. I think you're going to make the same point that the argument here is it's tactically it's more difficult for an African American president to appear to be highlighting the concerns of African Americans, and so it just makes more sense. Politically, that's, I think, the argument.
But it could be Nixon going to China. If Nixon could go to China, perhaps Obama could do that kind of outreach.
Is China African Americans?
It was back in the 70s.
So, well, Jimmy, go ahead.
Good to know.
Yeah, it is good to know. Jimmy, before I let you go, since you're our culture vulture here, the NAACP Image Awards is tonight. And some people have raised the question over some of the year's nominees. The Image Awards is giving an honor to Van Jones for he was fired, famously, or pushed out by the Obama administration because of some intemperate bad judgment in signing a petition that got the attention of the conservative punditocracy. And then there's this Michael Jackson Memorial Service, which is then being up for an award for outstanding variety. It's Michael Jackson's funeral. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Tacky.
Really?
Well, why are we giving out awards for funerals now? What's up with that? You know, next thing, you know, we're going to have somebody trying to outdo him. You know, trying to outdo Michael. You know, it's ugly.
It's not a good look, as you would say. All right. I'm sorry. We have to let it go for now. Thanks, everybody. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist for TheRoot.com and author of the book The Denzel Principle. He joined us from WCPN in Cleveland. Ruben Navarrete is a syndicated columnist who writes for the San Diego Union Tribune and CNN.com. He joined us from San Diego. Michael Fontroy is a professor of public policy at George Mason University and the author of Republicans and the Black Vote. He was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio along with Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, Political Junkie. I thank everybody so much for joining us. He is one of this country's most recognizable figures in this year's Winter Olympics, both because of who he is and what he has done. In 2006, Shawnee Davis became the first black athlete to win a gold medal in an individual event in the Winter Games. But then the grumbling started. The media complained he wouldn't do interviews, didn't practice with his team, and one teammate publicly accused him of being selfish. This year, he's done it again, going home with a gold in the 1,000-meter race and a silver in the 1,500. But the grumbling seems to have evaporated, and now Davis is looking ahead to 2014. But before he does that, he's with us by phone from Vancouver. Welcome and congratulations.
Why, thank you. Thanks for having me.
How does it feel the second time around? Does it feel sweeter? Is it sort of ho-hum? What's it like?
Well, I would say there's definitely been a relief of pressure and stressful situations off my shoulders. Just being able to come here and perform so well and be able to make history and to defend my 1,000-meter title from 4 years ago was very tremendous.
Your teammate Chad Hedrick says that he thought that the 1,500 was stolen from you. Do you agree?
No, I don't believe that anything belongs to you personally until you go out there and you race. You have to earn it. I mean, that's why you have the competition.
I think a lot of people, including your teammates, talked about the effort you put into that race. And I don't want to take anything away from the 1,000 where you won the gold, but just you just saw the effort on your face in the 1,500. Do you mind talking about what was going through your mind then?
Well, the ice wasn't very optimal for me. My skating style requires more finesse and strength. But, like, there's no real excuse to pinpoint my lack of strength that day. It was just the guy. He had a tremendous race, the guy from the Holland, and he had a lot of help in this race with his pairing because he got like a few big drafts, whereas I was out there by myself skating that whole thing by myself.
You sound good. You sound very zen, almost, I want to say. Do you feel more relaxed? Do you feel like you've just at a sort of a good place in your career and in your life?
Yeah, I mean, this is by far the best Olympics I've ever experienced, and I hope that this momentum continues on and carries throughout the rest of my skating career and my endeavors.
Why is that, though? You know, there was so much sort of grinching around you after the last Olympics and, you know, your attitude and yada, yada, yada. I mean, there was a nice moment this year with your teammate, Chad Hedrick, after you won the gold, where the two of you held up the American flag. I don't know, has just, what do you think's changed this time around that you seem to be having a great time, both athletically but personally?
Well, last time there was a lot of misunderstanding. There was a lot of miscommunication between what I was eligible to do and what I wasn't eligible to do. And things were misconstrued. It's something I actually wouldn't really like to revisit or talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It's over and it's done with, and I've moved forward from then. But I think the biggest difference is that people aren't on the attack to me, and I'm not on the defense trying to, you know, protect myself from people that are trying to scrutinize me.
I do want to ask, and for a lot of reasons, in part your achievements are certainly appreciated in their own right, but there is the added dimension of your being an African-American and being a trailblazer for your sport. And I do want to ask if you feel that race plays any part in the dynamic around you.
I mean, race is one of those things that you come into the world having. And what my coach always told me, he said when people ask him, he says his race is 1,000 meters, but you know, for me, it's a bit more obvious. My race is, I'm black. And I think it's a tremendous accomplishment, what I was able to do. But, I mean, I feel like we're so more forward and more advanced in times, and I don't think that it should be that big of a deal, really. I mean, it's not like I'm not allowed to go to the library and be educated or like I'm segregated. I mean, I have all the tools that I need to perform and compete.
So do you want to be in next year's Black History Month calendar or not?
Well, again, like I said, it's a tremendous accomplishment, and I'm not hiding the fact that I'm black. It's just that too many people, it's almost like they're taking away from me being being human. I'm human. Okay, and I'm black. There's tons of African-Americans that are successful in things that aren't dominated by African-Americans or blacks. I mean, this is a time and age where I feel it's not as important as what it used to be back in the day when people were held back and they weren't allowed to do things like maybe a Jackie Robinson or Jack Johnson. I mean, we're in 2010, so I mean, well, why does it have to be as big deal as it was? I mean, mm-hmm. It was in 2006, and 2010, I did it again. So, I mean, what's the big deal?
What does it take to be great at your sport?
I would say that you have to have heart, you have to have a lot of dedication, and then you have to have the passion to be able to go out there and put in the time. And you have to just have fun and enjoy yourself. Every day I step out on the ice, there's a new challenge for me. And I just have fun. I enjoy myself.
A lot of kids will be watch the Winter Olympics, and a lot of times when you talk to athletes who are competing, they'll say, "Well, I saw this when I was a kid, and this is what inspired me." So, for the kids who have been watching you this Olympics, what would you like them to learn from you?
Well, I just want them to know that if you go out there and you believe in the things that you're doing, and you believe in the things that you worked hard for throughout your life, and you're very passionate about it. It doesn't matter what people say or how people perceive it or take it. I mean, It's just work hard and, you know, truly believe in yourself and be strong. Be a strong individual. Learn how to be independent. Stay strong and stay focused, and, you know, don't quit until the job's done.
And finally, before we, as you were coming onto the program, you mentioned that you're actually on your way to practice, and you're still practicing. I think a lot of people would think, well, gosh, I thought, you know, the job's done, and, you know, time to go home and have a nice party. You're still competing. You're headed to races in Europe, right, after this. So I guess what I'm asking is, what's next for you, and what about 2014?
I told myself after 2006 that the silver medal and the 1,500 meters were push me and train me. It's going to give me great pleasure to be able to have the opportunity again to compete for the highest ranking in that race, which is a gold medal. So 4 years later, I came into the Olympics. I was much stronger, much more focused, much more hungry and driven. But I had a lot of pressure on me. But under all the circumstances, I was able to come away again with a gold and silver medal. I have four medals in my career now, two golds and two silvers. And I think it's not meant for me exactly to be done with the sport of speed skating. So I think that's why the things happened the way they did in the 1,500 meters. So I think there's something about me that has to go to Russia. And this, I don't know, I'm not going to say right away and disrespect my competitors and say I'm going for gold. I'm just going out there to do the best I can and hope that the best I can is the best that given day. But I'm just thrilled about having the opportunity to be able to compete. I love competing. I love the challenge. I just love the whole atmosphere of it.
You sure you don't want to be on the calendar now? Last chance.
You're not trying to put words in my mouth.
No, I'm just having fun with you.
Times. I am black. I am proud to be black. And nothing else that I would rather be. I'm
okay.
Very proud of it.
All right. Okay. I'm just teasing you. Come on.
Okay, you're just teasing me. Okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes I get defensive. I don't want anyone to misunderstand me. I'm 100% proud of what I am and what I've accomplished.
Shawnee Davis won gold and silver medals in this year's Winter Olympics, repeating his performance in the 2006 Olympics in Italy. He is the first African-American athlete, the first black athlete to win a Winter Games Olympic gold medal in an individual event. And he joined us by phone from Vancouver. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.